Accession number 2008, reel 5.
Dennis Wyvor, reel 5.
Well, that was our introduction to crocodiles. Of course, we'd had a short course on how to load the air bottles and the flame trail fuel and that in the trailers, and pressure up, and that all come through the knuckle into the front of the tank whereby you fired your shots, which it was kind of like rubber and petrol mixed, what you'd mend a tyre with, solution. That's what it sounded like to me. And you fired a 3-second burst, and that pushed out under pressure about 10 gallons of fuel.
Where was the fuel contained?
In the trailer, with the air bottles to pressure up your air bottles. And once you pressured up, you see, you didn't pressure up until you went into action, otherwise you'd lose pressure, you know, because you've got that come through a universal joint up and right under the tank and up in the co-driver's compartment into the gun. And that had a spark plug sort of thing, so that you either fired a wet shot or a dry shot. Dry shot was flame. A wet shot, you just fired, if it was a big thing you're firing at, you fire a couple of 3 wet shots and then a dry shot and a whole lot would go up, you know.
And how is it crewed? How many crew members were there?
Five in a crocodile, yeah, 5. You had a co-driver and a driver. Sorry.
Okay.
You had a co-driver, driver, a gunner, your main gunner. You still had the 75mm main gunner and a loader and a crew commander.
And how would you identify your targets when you were training? Did you have any training on what to look for?
Well, you see, when they used these, they used them on fixed defences, if you know what I mean. If Jerry dug in, or blockhouses or anything, and the infantry are held up, we'd go forward, the infantry behind us flame them, and then the infantry would go through. That was the main. We flamed over the canals in Holland.
But when you were training, what did you train on?
Well, we only just fired, we got the distance, we only just fired on ordinary bits of targets, and that there was nothing specific set up to fire at. You just got the effect of the thing, because we trained over, because they'd done away with the division and changed over rather quick, you know, to this thing.
So which division had you gone into?
79th Armoured Division. 79th Armoured Division. And we went down to, halfway between Portsmouth and Southampton, into a camp called A14, Fareham, I think it was. Is that a place called Fareham? We went down there and we waited and waited, you see, because they were going to send us over shortly after D-Day. But then they suddenly decided that with the Churchills and the flamethrowers, we were going to be a liability, because they weren't able to get stores and that across to keep them going right up through Belgium and that. And they wouldn't be able to supply us. So we waited in the camps there. We was in the camps there a hell of a while, really.
And what was your role at this time?
I was still in second in command tank, still operating, wireless operating. I was loading operator at that time.
And was that not a crocodile?
No. The command tanks weren't crocodiles. The squadron headquarters tanks weren't crocodiles. The only crocodiles were the ones under them. You see, we used to work in half squadrons. We used to have 8 tanks. And 2 headquarters tanks.
And what was the role of the headquarters tanks?
Well, he was in command, commanded the unit. He was the man to lead the attacks. They usually laid on the infantry and that. Well, I'll tell you about that when we get over. That'll come out, really.
Did you do any training with infantry while you were still in England?
No. No. I mean, that is the beauty of it all. We was changed over at the more or less the very last minute, really, you could say. I suppose they wanted, and the crocodiles were an ideal thing. They'd done well somewhere, and they thought they'd have another regiment of crocodile. So when we went down there, we said, I don't know whether it's September. You'll be able to find out if it's September or October before we sailed.
So you'd heard about you'd heard about D-Day.
Oh yes, we knew all about it. Our sergeants and that had been over with the command as commanding tanks. Some of them went over commanding tanks on the actual landing. They were hand-picked blokes, went over with the commando company.
Was that to gain experience?
And they all come back. They were back within, I should say, a week after D-Day. They were back in the regiment. Yeah. Then we got on the LSTs there. And we thought, Christ, we've gone over to Normandy, you know. And we got in the LSTs, somewhere near Portsmouth, it was, where they loaded them up, you know, run them on, and got all shackled up, set sail, you know. That was getting there in the evening time. Well, we thought we'd be there in the morning. You know, they just shunted us across the channel. When we woke up in the morning, we was lying off Southend Pier. We was lying off Southend Pier, not terribly near, but you know, we weren't terribly near the pier, but we could see Southend. I thought, well, that's bloody funny what they brought us all up this way for, because I knew Southend.
Oh, yeah. So you'd sail from Southampton to Southend?
Yeah, Portsmouth, we was round to Southend. Of course, they never told us where we were going. We knew we was going abroad, over the sea.
Had you made any kind of waterproofing methods for the crocodiles with you going
aboard? No, we knew. We didn't do it. We'd done all the waterproofing on the other tanks ready to go. But when the crocodiles came, they didn't do any waterproofing at all. We just drove on the LSTs, ratcheted them up, chained them up underneath there, and off we sailed. As I say, we got round to Southend Pier. And we kept going, I mean, and then all of a sudden we see this port coming up. And somebody said, that's Ostend. And we was going into Ostend. And what remarkable thing, we was the first LSTs in Ostend. And they took us a while to, you know, get us in, because the old civvy pilots and that man have got these tugs there around there getting us in, so we landed dry, you know. We just went up to the thing then, and the doors opened and we drove off onto the main street, Ostend.
What did Ostend look like? Had it been damaged at all?
Oh, it's been damaged a bit. Well, we spent the first night in a shop front and on the front, seafront there. And while we were there, on the ship, the Americans were coming over from a super football, well, flying fortresses were coming over from a raid, you know. And we see one of them just turn over and they'd been shot down. And saw the crew bail out and saw it hit the water, you know. And there was a SC rescue launch in the harbour there. And no sooner did they were up, I had bank to see here SA rescue launch and all the way, so they were, whether they got them or not. They looked near to us, but that took ages for the thing to get to us. Whether they picked the crew up, I suppose they did, but never see them come back with the crew. They might not have gone back to England with them, I don't know. Yeah, that. Then we went to Fruitbrush.
How did the vehicles move?
We was on tracks, yeah. We was on tracks then. We went, I remember our crew commander, Matt Reedon, took us up to one canal, and there was a bridge which they raised up and let down on four horses, and this was a wooden structure. And he told and had to go across it like and try it. We went over this thing, and when we got to the horses where they lifted it up and let it down for the barges to go in, I see these horses and I see it going down. He still kept going and going up the other side. There was about that much and drew across. That was only a narrow, just about the width. And we got across the other side and did that. There was an MP over the other side, I suppose. He's supposed to be looking after this breed. And of course, we got all the squadron behind us, because he was the squadron leader had gone on ahead, I suppose. And, God, this MP, did he carry on? Anyway, they had to turn round, the whole the rest of the squadron had to go all the way around. We finished up at a place called Fort LaSalle. That was one of the ring of forts built in the First World War to protect Antwerp. I don't know exactly where it was. I did know the name of it, but we spent about 3 or 4 days there, you know, shaking out, getting things organised.
What did that entail?
Well, it entailed, you see, once we went on the road, we had a lot of transport. This is why we never went over early. We had, they had hire lorries which towed the trailers. Your tank would be up on the transport. You had 10-ton lading lorries to carry the air bottles and fuel. Then you've got petrol. And everything else as a normal tank. So you've got quite a amount of stores and that to carry, besides, you know, in the echelon food and all the rest of it, ammunition for the 75s and that. The Haas and Leidens just done the trailers, the flamethrower fuel and the air bottles and all that. Because they're 10-tonners, so I mean they got a lot of weight in air bottles and that. Well, anyway, they shook down there. I mean, we more or less straightened ourselves out, tried things out. I suppose we was there about 3 or 4 days, and then we went up to a place called St Leonard's. That's near the Belgium Dutch border. And we were going into the attack next morning, I remember. And we pulled up just short of the start line, you know, where they had these start lines. And during the night, the infantry were going to do a night attack. So we pulled up just short of the start line. And there was, Jerry had been in there, there was, you know, a few little narrow, low trenches there and that. We stood there. I was on guard. I don't know what time it was. It was dark, anyway. And, blow me, if his searchlights in the same field as us, behind it, we'd not seen us. They opened up to direct the infantry in this attack. You know, they shone direction, the attack that was going, they shone on the clouds.
Was this artificial moonlight?
Yeah, yeah, and they shone on the clouds and kind of reflected down, and the Bofors guns fired a continuous burst, you know, in where they got to go. And of course, when they opened up with this searchlight, we were silhouetted there, all drawn up. And I was standing on guard with a, oh, Christ, what's his name? I forget his name now. He was the major's driver, and I was standing on guard with him. And I heard this lot whistling down, and I dived into a trench. It was, well, it was a bit bigger than that table, about that deep, you know. It was just about, you know, about a foot or so big. I dived in there. And Don Peary, that's the bloke's name, the major's driver, he dived on top of me. And you know this mortar that exploded, I don't know, must have been damn close. Because it's a horrible smell when you have a near one like that. So after they'd finished, Don said, I've been hit. So we drew him up and got him out of it and got him underneath the Churchill tank. It's about that much difference. Got him up underneath there.
What was that, about a foot, 2 foot?
Yeah, a foot, 2 foot. Yeah, you could lay down and that go, aren't you? Well, you got him up in there and got the old lamp out and got some first aid dressing. So I said, you're all right, Don. You've got a blighty here, mate. Caught all his leg, all out the back of his leg. Shrapnel all out the back of his leg. So they took him away, do the MO. And that's the last I see of him anyway. And another thing happened that night. Our Powdery, the regimental, he was a wonderful bloke. He came up to see us in to the on the start line to be with us. And he knew the infantry were going into attack, so he went up with the infantry MO to the town hall with his driver. He had a jeep. He went up to the town hall to see if he could help with the first aid, regimental aid post, you see. Because he knew there'd be casualties, I suppose. He was that sort of bloke. When he went up the steps, the two of them, the medical officer and the air powdery, a bomb, mortar bomb dropped right on the steps and killed them both. And his driver in the jeep down the bottom, I was waiting for him, never touched. That was a sad one, that one.
Who was the infantry you were supporting?
No, second, we supported, I don't know the infantry what was going in that night, but the next morning we continued the attack with the 2nd Essex. And we went in and flamed up the yard. I can't tell you whereabouts it was. Well, that was near St Leonard's, I know.
Did you have to do any preparations that morning for the attack?
No, we was all geared up for the attack. I mean, whenever we went into action, the first thing we done when we come back or pulled back or the echelon caught up was used to bomb up. And if it was near your rations, they knew how many days rations you got aboard. They'd sling you a boxer. 10-man packs, you know, and that used to last a crew about 10 men one day. It used to last about 4 days, I think, for the 4 men. That's how it split out. And we used to bomb up, fill up, and then we used to doss down for the night if we got time. But that was always that we filled up, tanked up. That was a set thing that we was ready to go. Before we, you know, relax more or less.
So was there a signal to say start the attack?
Oh, yes, it was all laid on at a certain time. Oh, it's all timed. These attacks were all timed to the minute. Now, if this is the thing about it. When you started with the English blokes, you started on a start line and we'd move forward and the infantry would be coming in not in close formation, what they call it. They'd be spread out.
Open formation.
Yeah, open formation. Yeah, they'd go up behind us in open formation. We'd go forward and you see, they already knew where the strong points were because they had aerial photography and that, and you get defence overprints with the mines and everything on. Oh, they knew where Jerry'd dug in and what he'd done. So therefore, they used to lay these attacks on.
So would you be allocated a strong point?
Oh, yeah, to be operating over a certain area. I mean, you'd have eight tanks over an area. And you go forward, you don't necessarily make a beeline straight for it. It all depends what happens. If you've got an 88 or an SP gun or something like that, you have to go from one side to the other. But, you know, it's tactics, really. What means you keep out of sight and get as near to the objective as possible without being seen. That is the art in tanks. I mean, that is the art in tanks used in the country. I mean, using whatever bit of country you've got, you know, gullies, and you never come up on top of a hill. That's a thing you never do, because as soon as you got your belly up there, they can put a blinking two-pounder right through the bottom of it. I mean, you never expose yourself more than you can. You try to keep hold down until you get to the objective. The nearer, well, you see, you've got to get about 100 and some odd yards, about 110 yards before you can leave the frame part. That if you got within that, I mean, machine guns and mortars didn't worry you. And you flamed that. Jerry didn't stay long. He turned and went. They didn't like that. That's fearful. And some of the infantry wouldn't go through it who haven't been used to it. Because you can walk through it once it's down. I mean, once that's gone down, you can walk straight through it. But when you get the other side, you've got to put the earth on your boots because they're sticking to your boots, and just wipe it off. You can do it. And I said, all right.
Were you given any? Was there any tank units supporting you, or did you have to give yourself supporting?
No, we had our own 75 support. We used to support ourselves. Yeah. We had other tanks at times. You know, I mean, it all depends what units we're going in with. But mostly we went on our own with infantry.
So on that morning when you attacked near St Leonard's, can you remember what happened once you'd gone over the start line?
Well, I remember we moved up. They flamed two or three farmhouses on the way up, and some Jerry's come back for us with their hands up, you know. And we went on, and we get somewhere or the other, they got held up, and that was just short of a village or somewhere, or some houses, as far as I can remember. And we sat there all day, well, not all day, just a couple of hours, I suppose, more. And Jerry mortared us incessantly. So the infantry didn't come anywhere near us, well, they. But we could do that. I mean, it didn't matter as long as we didn't get out or didn't have to get out. You know, if you did get out, you got back in a hurry. You didn't expose yourself longer, because Jerry was a master of mortars. I found out the Germans were a master of mortars. They could drop them on a sixpence, as they say. Yeah, they were very good.
So you would stay battened down during the mortar? the turret?
Oh, yeah. Well, you would. We'd probably have the turret open, turret lid open. We wouldn't batten down completely. But you could see through your periscope, you know, you see all you want to see without getting your head up and top.
And your role in this, you were the wireless operator for the second command?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
What were you doing? Were you passing messages on between?
Oh, yeah, well, you see, mostly he commanded the troops where to move. They gave them orders, you know. And when he used to come back at night, you see, I used to have to get in touch with the echelons and say, give the position where we were, and they used to bring up the supplies there, you know, bomb up and that. Oh, yeah, it's